Chapter 3. The blue cutter was 18 feet long, and with 13 men in the boat it was uncomfortably crowded, dangerously low in the water. They were silent, and for the most part motionless, squeezed into what little shade they could find. Precious little under the high tropical sun, but more now that it was fast declining from its height, well down the western sky ahead. A sensible relief, for the blaze directly overhead at noon might have been called intolerable, but for the fact that they had borne it. They had a good deal to bear, apart from the heat and the overcrowding, fear, hunger, thirst, and sunburn, and of these sunburn was the most immediate. Their shirts now formed the small shoulder-of-mutton sail that was to carry them across the ocean to Brazil, and although their faces and forearms were tanned beyond the reach of any sun, their backs were not. Those with pigtails had unplaited them and spread the long hair as some kind of a shield, but that was not much use against such a blaze, and their backs were fiery red or purple, cracked and peeling, or quite raw. For although the cutter was properly fitted with oars, stretchers, mast and cordage, its sails had formed part of the boatswain's perquisites at the Cape, their loss being disguised by a small piece of canvas stuffed with junk. There were a few jackets in the boat, and these were passed wetted to those that took their places on the sunward side, turn and turn about at each hypothetical bell. As for fear, it had always been present from the moment it replaced their intense relief at escaping from the burning ship, and it had increased during the blow that separated the boats the very night La Flèche took fire, a series of squalls that cut up such a sea that they all sat on the weather gunwale to keep the waves out with their close-pressed backs, bailing furiously the while, one bailer and a couple of hats between them. After that, fear had dropped to something more like a steady anxiety, tempered with confidence. Captain Aubrey had stated that he knew where they were, and that he would take them to San Salvador in Brazil, and if any man could pull them through, it was he. Yet it had revived these last few days, with the biscuit and the water dwindling so, and never a fish, never a turtle on the vast expanse of deep blue sea. Even Captain Aubrey could not bring rain out of this implacably pure sky, nor increase the small parcel of biscuit that lay by him as he sat in the stern sheets, steering the cutter westwards. Beneath him, carefully wedged and covered, stood the mess kid with a few remaining pints of water. He would serve out a third of a mug at sunset, together with the third part of a biscuit. The doctor would add a certain quantity of sea water, and that would be all, the kid quite empty. There might be dew to lick from the mast and gunwales, and to suck from the sail, it happened sometimes, but that would not keep them going long, any more than the urine they had been drinking this last week. Since Wednesday, the doctor had been pointing out birds that he said were never seen more than a few hundred miles from land, and they had all felt encouraged. But with these light, variable airs, a few hundred miles might mean another week, and they no longer had the strength to pull for any length of time if the breeze failed them. They had chewed all the goodness out of their leather belts or shoes, and when the biscuit was gone, all was gone. No one complained, but each knew very well that he could not last a great while now. And though hope was not gone, nor nearly gone, the anxiety weighed very heavy in the boat.
"Change over," said the captain in a hoarse croak.
The jackets were wetted and passed to the men who were to take their place in the bows, and there was a general post. Yet even with this moving around, the main order did not vary. The captain sat in the stern sheets, the two lieutenants by him, the midshipmen further forward, then the leopards, and then the three flitches they had picked up, men who had flung themselves over the side in the confusion and had lost their own boats. Each man sat by his belongings, such as they were. Sometimes they were the effect of chance, of what happened to be at hand in the last moment, and sometimes they seemed to show what each man had valued most. Jack Aubrey had his chronometer beside him, next to the biscuit, the heavy cavalry sabre he had used for many years, and a pair of pistols. He had come off better than most, since Killick, having a few minutes longer warning, had also caught up a sheaf of the captain's papers, his best telescope, and half a dozen of his best frilled shirts, fresh from the ironing board. But the shirts were now part of the sail's afterleech. Babington had preserved his commission. Byron, the official journals and certificates he would need if his acting rank were to be confirmed, and a sextant. One midshipman still had his dirk, and the two others their silver spoons. Several of the foremast hands had saved their ditty bags, often beautifully embroidered, their housewives, and of course their knives. Dr. Maturin's locked writing case stood on his diary, and his new wig on that. He himself could not be seen except for his fingers clinging to the gunwale, because he was hanging in the sea. Sweat could not evaporate in water, and there might possibly be some penetration of the pure fluid through the pervious membrane of his skin.
"Would you give me a hand now?"
he said, heaving himself to chest height on the side. Bondon stood up, and as he did so the breeze caught his long, loose hair covering his face. He turned to windward to blow it back, stiffened, stared, and said to Jack,
"A sail, sir, right on the starboard beam."
No discipline, on land or sea, could withstand this. As Jack stood up, so did every other soul in the boat. The cutter took a wild weather lurch and very nearly shipped to sea.
"Sit down, you goddamned lubbers!"
cried Jack, a loud, inhuman sound. They sat down at once, for they had seen all that mattered, a ship on the northern horizon, topsails up. Jack stood on the midship's thwart, steadied himself, and looked long and hard with his glass. The light was perfect. Three times on the rise he saw her hull.
"Probably an Indiaman," he said. "Bondon, Hubbard, Rakes, sit on the larboard gunwale. Ready about."
The distant ship was sailing on the opposite tack, something south of east, with the wind at north, making 6 or 7 knots. He put the boat about and steered a course to intercept her. The question was, could he do so before nightfall? The sudden, tropical nightfall, with no twilight to prolong the day. Could he urge the cutter through the sea so as to get within view of the lookouts before the sun went down? It would be a near-run thing. The same thought was in every mind, and many an eye glanced at the sun. The men on the weather gunwale leaned out to make the boat more stiff, and already the other hands were dashing water against the sail so that no breath of air should pass through it and be lost.
"Gillick,"
said Jack,
"do what you can by way of a staysail, with handkerchiefs, ditty bags, anything at all."
"Aye, aye, sir."
The precious bags were handed over without a murmur. Knives slit their seams. Some men twisted rope yarn into thread. Others sent needles running through and through. A cruel task, since the sailmakers and their mates could not take more than an occasional glance at the ship.
"Mr. Babington,"
said Jack again,
"spread out the powder in my flask to dry."
There was little need for this in so blazing hot a boat, but he wanted to be quite certain of a signal at the last extremity. Their courses were slowly converging. Now, even without standing up, the men in the cutter could see the ship's black, checkered hull as she rose, and a kind of parched cheer went up as the tiny new sail, a parti-coloured triangle, climbed the stay, and all hands felt the very slightly greater thrust. But God, the sun was sinking so. Every time they looked astern, a hand's breadth lower, and though no man spoke, they felt that the breeze was sinking too. The lively run of water down the side was dying away. There was no need for anyone to lean out to keep the boat stiff to the wind, for wind there was almost none. Yet she was well within a mile, maybe a mile and a half, and still on their larboard bow. She had not crossed them yet. She was not going from them yet. The distance would still diminish till she crossed, and the lookouts must see them any moment now. Jack stared at the sea, the sky, sinking sun, the uncertain signs of wind.
"Out oars,"
he said, naming the strongest men.
"We must make a dash for it."
Another half mile and the most careless lookout could not miss them. Another half mile and they would be within hail, within the sound of pistol shot, and the sun was still clear of the sea.
"Stretch out! Stretch out!"
he cried, right into the labouring stroke-oar's agonised, contorted face. They stretched out, and now the water raced foaming down the side. The ship came nearer fast, and right ahead he could see men moving on her deck. Had they no lookout at all?
"Stretch out! Stretch out! In oars and face about! Now all together hail! 1, 2, 3, ahoy!
Ahoy! Ahoy! The ship ahoy!"
The ship let fall her t'gallants, sheeted home. She gathered way, her bow wave increasing with her speed. The seas blew darkened fast with the setting of the sun.
"Ahoy! Ahoy!"
Jack fired both pistols, a fine ringing crack.
"Ahoy! ahoy! Oh, Christ, ahoy! The ship, ahoy!
Quite desperate now. The ship crossed the cutter's bows at half a mile, her bow wave rising much whiter now, her wake stretching far. Every second the distance grew.
Ahoy! Ahoy!
Tearing their throats in fury, and the quick darkness spread. Stars beyond the ship. She lit her stern lantern, a top light, and the top light moved fast away among the stars. Silence, but for the painful gasping of the men who had pulled so hard, rowing their hearts out, and for the dry sobs of the youngest reefer. The rowers lay in the bottom of the boat. One of them, a big, heavy-boned man named Rakes, stopped breathing for a moment. Stephen leant over him, massaging his chest and throwing water on his face. After a while he revived and sat there, bowed, without a word.
"Do not be downhearted, shipmates," said Jack at last. "She is carrying a top-light, as you see. That proves we are in the track of shipping. Now I shall serve out supper, and shape course for land. I will lay any man 10 guineas to a shilling. We see a ship or land, or both, tomorrow."
"I will not take you, sir,"
said Babington, as loud as his racked voice could speak.
"It is a certainty."
A little after moonrise, Stephen woke. Extreme hunger had brought on cramps in his midriff again, and he held his breath to let them pass. Jack was still sitting there, the tiller under his knee, the sheet in his hand, as though he had never moved, as though he were as immovable as the Rock of Gibraltar, and as unaffected by hunger, thirst, fatigue, or despondency. In this light he even looked rock-like, the moon picking out the salient of his nose and jaw, and turning his broad shoulders and upper man into a single massive block. He had, in fact, lost almost as much weight as a man can lose and live, and in the day his shrunken, bearded face with deep-sunk eyes was barely recognizable. But the moon showed the man unchanged. He saw that Stephen was awake, and a white flash appeared as he smiled. He leant forward, patted Stephen's shoulder, and pointed north.
"Docking,"
was the only word he uttered, all his parched tongue could do. Stephen followed his pointing arm, and there to windward he saw no stars, but a prodigious blackness, shot with inward lightning.
"Soon,"
said Jack. And half an hour later he brought out an inarticulate bellow near enough to all hands to rouse those that could be roused. Rakes, the big quarter-gunner belonging to La Flesh, was dead, and the other rowers were likely to follow him quite soon, unless they had some relief. He had died with a startled gasp and uncomprehending stare as supper was serving out, and they had not put him over the side, although no man had yet spoken of eating his body.
"Sail!"
croaked Jack.
"Funnel! Kid!"
Abruptly the northern breeze veered due south, a pause on the uneasy sea while the darkness raced across the sky. The first drops fell as hail, great hailstones that drew blood, and then, driving from the north once more, the sheets of rain came down, filling their open, offered mouths, washing their upstretched arms, their burnt, salt-crusted bodies.
"Quick! Quick!"
cried Jack, much louder now as he directed the flow of water from the horizontal sail into the kid and every other receptacle they possessed. But he need not have troubled. Long after they were filled, the rain went on, pouring down so that they could hardly breathe as they wallowed in pure luxury, absorbing it at every pore, pouring down with a universal hiss and roar so that they even had to bail it out, throw the precious stuff over the side to keep afloat. It was while they were bailing that Babington called out,
"Oh!" and then, "It's something soft!"
This was the first of a shower of flying squids, hundreds and hundreds of them that passed all round and over the boat, some hitting the men and falling into the fresh water in the bottom of the boat, glowing with a faint phosphorescent light, coupling in an intricacy of arms. Too many for any call to share. The men hunted them down, scrabbling fore and aft, scrabbling under the dead man's legs, and ate them alive. The darkness was gone. The moon shone out again, and in the north the stars were brighter still. Stephen found that he was cold, even shivering. His belly was like a filled sack, heavy, as if it were a foreign body.
"Here, sir,"
said Forshaw in his ear,
"here's my jacket. Stretch out on the thwart and take a caulk. It'll be dawn in an hour or two. and now we can hold out for another week at least. You will be quite all right.
Dawn. The first light rising to the zenith. A pure sky over a sea swathed in white, swirling mists. Mists filled with changing, dreamlike shapes, some in the form of clouds. Then all at once the sun's upper limb. Then the whole sun itself flattened like a lemon, but a lemon of enormous blazing power that rounded as it climbed, dispelling the mists with its horizontal rays. And there, where the mists had been, lay not one ship, but two, directly to leeward, 2 miles away. The nearer had backed her for topsail to speak the other, and yet it was terribly like a mirage. No one uttered any distinct, firm word until Jack had put the boat before the wind, and they were running down at 4 or 5 knots on a true steady breeze. There was no chance that the ship could escape them, for ship she was, no mirage could hold so still so long, and almost no chance that they had not already been seen, since the ship was a man of war, her pennant streaming in the wind. Nationality unsure, for her colours, British, French, Dutch, Spanish, or even American, were blowing from them, a hint of blue, no more, but in any case a present paradise. Yet no man dared tempt fate. They sat rigid, staring with all their force across the sea, willing the boat on. Total silence until Jack handed the tiller to Babington, crept stiffly forward with his glass, and almost instantly said,
"Ours, Blue Ensign. Java, by God. Yes, Java. I should have known her anywhere. T'others are Portuguese."
A hum of talk. Java. All the leopards who had served with Jack before knew her well. She had been the French renommée, taken off Madagascar. A fine, plump, 38-gun frigate.
"They have seen us," said Jack.
He had the officer of the watch in his objective glass, and the officer, telescope levelled, was looking straight at him. The question arose, should they now slip rakes over the side? It seemed more proper, in a way. It was bad luck to keep a corpse aboard. Java might still fill her topsail and away. Besides, he had swollen shockingly, and although no one mentioned it, part of his left thigh had been eaten in the night. The squids were a thin, unsubstantial fare to fill such an enormous hunger. "No," said his shipmates from La Flèche. "No, now they had got him so far, he should have a parson. It should be done right, with a hammock and 2 round shot, and the words read over him."
"Quite right," said Jack. "But cover him decently for now, and, doctor, I will trouble you to put on your apron."
In the last 1,000 yards, when they could see the Java's side lined with watching figures, they suddenly became self-conscious. Tie-for-tie pairs formed, plaiting pigtails. The officers plucked at what clothing they possessed and fingered their beards. Nearer and nearer still, and at last the hail.
"What are ye?"
In the sudden gaiety of his heart, now that the last tension was gone, Jack thought of facetious replies such as "The Queen of the May," or "The 7 Champions of Christendom. But this would not do, not with a corpse aboard. He called out,
"Shipwrecked mariners!"
Let fly the sheets, and brought the boat kissing up against the Java's side. No side boys, no bosun's call for Captain Aubrey this time. But seeing the state of the cutter's crew, the officer sent a couple of powerful men down with man-ropes, and one of these said to Jack,
"Can you get up the side, mate?"
"I believe so, thank ye,"
said Jack, springing for the cleats. His head felt very strange when he stood up, but he felt that at all costs he must go aboard correctly. The point of honour was concerned. Fortunately, the Java had a fine tumble-home. Her sides sloped steeply in from near the waterline, and with a couple of heaves and the help of the roll he was on the quarter-deck. The unusually crowded quarter-deck. He straightened, though his knees trembled beneath him. Reaction was fast setting in. Touched his hat to no particular person, but rather to that august sweep of deck, concentrated his gaze on the advancing officer and said,
"Good morning, sir. I am Captain Aubrey, late of Leopard, and I should be obliged if you would inform your captain."
The young man's face expressed wonder, astonishment, perhaps incredulity. But before he could speak, a small, round, brisk man stepped forward from the group of figures somewhat aft and cried,
"Aubrey? By God, so it is! I did not recognise you. Thought you was lost a great while since. How come you here? Your Excellency," to a tall figure in white just behind him, "allow me to name Captain Aubrey of the Navy. General Hislop,
Governor of Bombay."
Jack's head swam, but he managed a civil bow, a
"Your servant, sir,"
and a kind of smile at the governor's words.
"Knew your father.
Delighted. Most interesting occasion."
Then, unable to recall the name of the familiar face before him, he said,
"Captain, may my men be seen to? They are quite knocked up. My surgeon will need a bosun's chair, and we have a corpse with us. Pray tell me, have you any news of boats from La Flèche?"
No news, alas, and Captain Lambert, for Lambert was his name, having given orders, urged Jack to come below.
"Come, take my arm. A glass of brandy."
"I will just see my people aboard," said Jack.
He would have given the world to sit on the carronade slide just by him, but he stood there while the leopards and the flitches reached the deck. He introduced his officers, and he even noticed that the Jarvas made a poor fist of hoisting the boat on deck. When he reached the cabin, and when Captain Lambert was calling for "a glass of brandy there, and mince pies, but only small ones, you hear me? Only small ones!" he was obliged to steer his way, half-blind, to the quarter-gallery, and there he fell.
"The fall very nearly came before the pride," he said to himself as he half lay, half reclined there, no room to measure his unusual length, wonderfully comfortable and relaxed. And much later, "What did he mean by mince pies? Lambert is his name, Harry Lambert. He had active in the year 2, cut out the Scipion, married Maitland's sister. Mince pies. Why, of course. It must be Christmas in a day or two."
It was indeed. And in spite of the enormous sun, the Jarvas galley turned out puddings and pies in prodigious quantities, enough for well over 400 men and boys with healthy appetites, and for 12, whose lust for food was barely human. She was a fine, dry, quick-sailing weatherly ship, with plenty of headroom between decks, and she would have been called roomy by naval standards if she had carried only the normal complement for a 38-gun frigate. But she was bound for Bombay, and she had the new governor aboard, with his numerous suite, and as though that were not enough, drafts for the Cornwallis, Chameleon, and Icarus had been joined to them, so that where 300 men could have turned and breathed and fed with something like ease, 400 could not. On punishment days there was scarcely room to swing the cat effectively, and the accommodation of 12 more presented serious difficulties. Difficulties in the matter of volume, not of victuals. The Java was a well-found ship, her lower depths still crammed with sheep, swine, and poultry, in addition to her ordinary stores, and although her captain was known to be poor, she had a comparatively wealthy gunroom, and the catering officer at once ordered a massacre of geese, ducks, sucking pigs. Yet in spite of the season and the rich smell of festivity, there was no Christmas spirit in the ship at all. Stephen's first impression was that she was the gloomiest vessel he had ever known. Her people were kind, none kinder. They re-rigged their guests in the most open-handed way. The tallest lieutenant provided clothes for Captain Aubrey, and Captain Lambert provided the marks of splendour due to his rank, while the Jarvas surgeon gave Stephen his best coat and breeches, to say nothing of the anonymous linen that appeared in his cabin. But there was no merriment aboard, and when, after a long night's perfect sleep, a shave, a visit to his worst sunburns in the sick bay, and a turn on deck, Stephen made acquaintance with the gunroom as a body at breakfast, he thought them a strangely mum-chance crew. Never a smile, never a single one of those flights of naval wit, flabby puns, traditional jokes, proverbs, saws to which he was accustomed and which he now so curiously missed. It was not that they were short of talk. On the contrary, there was a great deal of conversation, but it was all dogged, glum, declamatory, indignant, or angry. It was all highly professional, too, and it seemed to him that he had only exchanged the boredom of La Flèche for a greater boredom still, since here, too, it was all about the Navy of the United States, and here there were twice as many men at table.
"Oh, for women at sea to obviate the eternal cross-cat harpings," he said to himself, "to do away with the grumbling futtocks and to inject a little civilization, even of an equivocal nature, even at the risk of moral deviation."
He was the first of the leopards to appear, and apart from offering him coffee, tea, mutton chops, bacon, eggs, soused herrings, cold pie, ham, butter, toast, and marmalade, and seeing to his comfort, few people spoke to him. He was obviously still much reduced by his ordeal. He was thought to be deaf, and their surgeon had told them that he was not to be excited.
He has an ugly, livid countenance that argues some damage to the heart.
The master did ask him what he thought of the president, but he replied,
A most unfortunate choice, sir. No bottom, weak, easily blown from side to side.
Indeed, sir, cried the master,
and several other officers paid close attention.
He may be a tolerable Hebrew scholar. He may have genteel, insinuating manners and a handsome wife. He may overflow with private virtues, but there is the evil, corrupting love of power, the consuming lust for office.
I was referring to the ship, sir, to the frigate, president.
Oh, as for the ship, I am not qualified to form any opinion at all.
The master turned to his neighbour, who had something to offer on the subject of scantlings, as they were understood in the United States. So, as neither Babington nor Byron was yet afoot, Stephen escaped the American Navy by swallowing his breakfast in a few quick snaps, in spite of his colleague's warning, not to eat too much, to chew every mouthful 40 times, took a couple of pinches of fortifying snuff, returned to the deck, and asked for news of Captain Aubrey. Captain Aubrey, too, was still asleep, and pleasantly enough the words were uttered in a little above a whisper, in spite of the hullabaloo that filled the ship from stern to stern. Stephen took a few more turns in the brilliant morning sun, revelling in the luxury of clean linen, of any linen at all. The others on the quarter-deck watched him with discreet curiosity, and he watched the working of the ship. Even to his unprofessional eye it seemed a little haphazard. Surely there was more noise, more instruction, more pushing men into place than was usual. Forshaw interrupted his thoughts, a strangely transformed Forshaw, not only in that he was clothed, and clothed in garments far too big for him, but in that he had never a smile. His face looked as though he had been crying, and in a low voice he told Stephen that,
if he were at leisure, Captain Aubrey would be glad to have a word with him. I hope that child has not had bad news, said Stephen to himself, walking to the cabin. Some letter announcing death, sent out and here received. On top of what he has experienced, it might have very ill effects. I shall give him half of a blue pill.
But the look of grief was not peculiar to young Forshaw. It was plain upon Jack's face, too, and even more pronounced, a look of shock and deep unhappiness. Captain Lambert, already straightened for room, had moved the Java's master from his day cabin for his latest guest, and here Jack sat, wedged between an 18-pounder gun and the chart table, with a pot of coffee on the locker beside him. He gave a poor smile as he wished Stephen good morning, asked him how he did, and invited him to share his pot.
First, show me your tongue and let me take your pulse, said Stephen, and a moment later, you have had bad news, brother?
Of course I have, said Jack in a low, vehement tone. Surely you have heard?
Not I.
I will put it in half a dozen words. It don't bear dwelling on, said Jack,
putting down his untasted cup.
Tom Dacres, in Guerriere, 38, met the American Constitution, 44, brought her to action, of course, and was beat. Dismasted, taken, and burnt. Then their sloop Wasp, 18, tackled our brig Frolic of almost exactly the same weight of metal, and took her too. Then United States, 44, and our Macedonian, 38, had a fight off the Azores, and Macedonian struck to the Americans. Two of our frigates and a sloop have struck to the Americans, and not one of theirs to us.
In his diary that night, Stephen wrote,
I do not believe I have ever seen Jack so moved. If he had heard of Sophie's death, he would no doubt have felt an even keener, even crueler emotion, but it would have been a personal grief, whereas this is beyond self, except in so far as he is entirely identified with the Royal Navy. It is, after all, his life. This series of defeats, without a single victory in the first months of a war, is striking enough, particularly since the frigate is the very type of the fighting ship, but it is of no real consequence. This whole American war, and a fortiori these defeats, which scarcely affect the enormous British naval force at all, is essentially irrelevant. Furthermore, the defeats themselves can readily be explained, and I have no doubt the Ministry is busily explaining them at this moment to a shocked, an outraged public opinion. The Americans brought larger frigates with more and heavier guns to the task. Their ships are manned by volunteers, I understand, and not by what the press gang, the quota system, and the jails can provide. But no, this will not do. There is no comfort for the sailors here. The British army may be defeated again and again. That can be accepted. But the navy must always win. It always has won these last 20 years or so. Nor is there any record of serious naval defeat since the Dutch wars. The navy has always won, and it must always continue to win handsomely whatever the odds. I remember the unfortunate Admiral Calder, who, with 15 line-of-battle ships, met Monsieur de Villeneuve with 20, and who was disgraced because he took only 2 of them. 20 years of victory and some inherent virtue must offset heavier guns, larger ships, more men. And although I have hitherto regarded the navy more as a medium in which to work, although I do not feel that the heavens have fallen, nor that the foundations of the universe are subverted, I must confess that I am not unmoved. I feel no hint of animosity against the Americans, except in so far as their action may to some degree help Bonaparte, though it would do my heart, as I term the illogical area of my being, and what an expanse it does cover on occasion, it would do my heart good to hear of some compensating victory. Christmas Day, and Jack, Stephen, and Babington dined with Captain Lambert, General Hislop, and his aide-de-camp. It was a creditable spread, and they ate a good many geese, pies, and puddings, but Jack caught Lambert's anxious eye on the wretched wine, and his heart was moved for him. Jack, too, had been a captain with nothing but his pay, compelled to entertain voracious, thirsty guests. The soldiers were gay enough, although General Hislop did refer to the unfortunate effect these recent events would have in India, where moral force counted for so much, and the others did their best. Yet upon the whole, with its factitious merriment, it was not a very successful feast, and Stephen was glad when Captain Lambert suggested showing them the ship. A long tour it was, with Jack and Lambert pausing by each of the 18-pounder guns, each of the 32-pounder carronades, and by the 2 long nines, discussing their qualities. Yet this too had its end. Jack and Stephen retired to the master's day cabin, where they sat eating ship's biscuit from their pockets. They could both eat without a stop, and they both did so almost automatically. Their future was clear. The Java had taken a prize, a fair-sized American merchantman that was to meet her off San Salvador, where they were both to water. This prize, the William, was a slow-sailing vessel, and Captain Lambert had left her behind while he went in chase of the Portuguese ship the Java had brought to when the cutter saw her. They would move into the William in a few days' time, and either take passage in her to Halifax or go straight to England in some other ship from San Salvador. Acasta was still on the Brest blockade, and she had a jobbing captain, Peter Fellows, to keep her warm for Jack.
"I'm glad Lambert has a decent prize at last," said he. "He's always been a most unlucky wight, and never was there a man who needed money more. Half a dozen boys and an invalid wife. No luck at any time. If ever he took a merchantman, it was retaken before it reached home, and of the 3 enemy ships he captured, 2 sank under him, and he had battered the 3rd so hard that government refused to buy her for the service. Then he was on shore for a couple of years, living in lodgings in Gosport with all his brood, a damned uneasy life, and now they have given him Java, about as expensive a command as he could wish, burning to have a go at the Americans, like all of us, and then to be sent off to Bombay with a ship full of guests, no chance of distinguishing himself, and precious little of any prizes. They might have sent Hislop in an Indiaman. It was cruel to tie up a fellow like Lambert, as good a fighting captain as any man afloat. And what a crew!
What is the matter with them? Are they disaffected, mutinous?
No, no. They are honest creatures, I believe, God help them. But I doubt he has 100 real seamen aboard. How they contrived to take the William I cannot imagine, with so many landsmen and assorted vermin in the ship. Such a Bartholomew Fair, striking to gallant masts, I have rarely seen. It reminded me of our early days in Polycrest. And as for the forward guns at quarters... But it is not fair to judge Lambert or his officers. She is only 40-odd days out of Spithead, and she had foul weather for the first 20 of them, so they have not had time to work up their gun crews. They will come to it in time, I dare say. Lambert has a very good notion of gunnery, and Chads, his first lieutenant, is a very scientific officer. He dearly loves a gun.
What did Captain Lambert mean by saying, when you suggested a real discharge, a live discharge, that you were to remember the regulation, and that he had already been rapped on the knuckles for exceeding his allowance?
Why, there is a strict rule that for the first 6 months of a commission, no captain is allowed to fire more shot a month than 1/3 the number of his guns, and after the first 6 months, only half as much.
Then you must have infringed the regulation almost every day. I scarcely remember quarters without the firing of guns. sometimes all of them, on both sides, with small arms and swivels from the tops as well.
Yes, but that was powder and shot I had either captured or bought. Most captains who can afford it, and who care for gunnery, get round the regulation that way. Lambert cannot afford it, and although Chads might be able to, he could not possibly put himself forward.
Mr. Chads is wealthy, I collect. Did he do well in prize money?
Not that I have ever heard of. He went a far more compendious way about it, cut out the only daughter of a Turkey merchant in very dashing style with a chaise and four, a 30,000-pounder, I have heard tell.
Mr. Chads might be rich, but he was not proud, nor was he impatient. Early in the morning, some days later, when they had raised the high land of Brazil and were in hourly expectation of the William, Stephen came across him in the bows, showing a particularly stupid, though willing, gun crew how to point their weapon. Again and again he made them and their midshipmen heave it in and out, go through the motions of loading, taking aim, and firing. He clapped onto the tackles himself, plied the handspike, tried to make them understand the ideas of elevation, point-blank range, line of metal, the difference between firing on the upward and the downward roll. He praised their real efforts, saved two of the duller landsmen from having their feet crushed off by the moving carriage, and promised they should fire a live round at a target presently. He showed them how to bows their gun tight against its port, and make all fast, so that the 2 tons of concentrated weight should not start lurching about the deck. And then, wiping his face, he joined the doctor, saying, "They will do very well. Good, sensible, steady men." "Surely, sir," said Stephen, "it must call for a very nice appreciation of distance, of angle, and of direction, to judge the right moment for firing off a piece, when both the deck and the target are in motion."
"It does, Doctor, it does indeed," said Chads. "But it is wonderful what use will do. Some men get the knack of it very soon, a matter of eye and tact, and they will fire amazingly well at 1,000 yards after a couple of months."
"On deck there!"
hailed the lookout from on high in an unemphatic tone.
"Sail fine on the starboard bow!"
"Is she, William?"
called the officer of the watch.
"William she is, sir," replied the lookout after a considering pause. "And a closing of us fast!"
Chads glanced towards the remote loom of Brazil to the westward and said,
"I shall be glad to have her alongside again. There are 3 of my best gun captains in the prize crew and 1 landsman who has come along amazingly. But we shall be losing you and the other leopard, sir, and we shall all be sorry for that."
"I shall be sorry too. I should have liked another view of your ingenious sight. There were some points that I did not quite apprehend." Mr. Chads had invented a device designed to take some of the uncertainty out of gunnery at sea, and adapted to the meanest understanding, and he had spent the evening hours of Thursday explaining it to Stephen.
"But I suppose that I must pack up my belongings?"
They were not inconsiderable. The Java's gunroom had done the Leopards proud, and Stephen, for one, had never possessed so many handkerchiefs in his life. But the word brought his vanished collections to his mind. He dismissed them at once. A woman whose acquaintance he greatly valued had once remarked that it was foolish to reflect on the past, except where that past was agreeable. He did his best to observe the precept, but it was not much use. A sense of bereavement would keep breaking in. Nor had it been much use to the lady in question. She had withered away after the death of his cousin Kevin, a young man in the Austrian service. A slow packer he was, and inefficient. If Killick had not come to him, having stowed the captain's sea bag, Stephen might have gone on staring at the handkerchiefs, the neckcloths, and the warm weather drawers until the drum called him away to dinner.
"Come, sir, show a leg," said Killick angrily. "William's alongside. We'll never get a decent cabin without your show a leg. Mr. Babington and Mr. Baron and all them wicked reefers nipping aboard of her like ferrets, swiping all the decent berths. This is no good at all,"
upending the sailcloth bag and starting again. He packed with quick, deft movements and grew more nearly amiable.
"There's a fine howdy-do on deck, sir," he said. "A sail in the offing, and the whole quarter-deck are staring through their spy-glasses. Some say she's a Portuguese razee."
"What is a razee?"
"Why, a cut-down ship of the line, in course. Upper deck cut off, and all her guns behind 1 line of ports. Surely you know that, sir. Howsomever, Bonden been up at the jacks this last glass, and swears she's their constitution, which he saw her and went aboard to visit his friend Joe Warren when they were in the Med, tickling up the Barbary States. But never mind, sir, you're quite safe. You'll be aboard William and in a decent berth too in 5 minutes, or my name's not Preserved Killick."
No one on the quarterdeck was as positive as Bonden. The nature, the relative size of a ship might easily be mistaken at such a distance, and there was a strong likelihood of her being the Portuguese Rezee that was known to be in these waters. But Stephen walked into an atmosphere of eager hope and confident expectation. His colleague, Fox, for example, was transformed from a bowed, depressed, though kindly middle-aged man to an upright, bright-eyed creature no older than his assistants. He turned his flushed face to Stephen and cried, "Give your joy, Dr. Maturin! I believe we have the enemy under our lee!" Stephen stared over the water south and west at the white glint of sails, and he heard Captain Lambert say to Jack, "It is no more than a possibility, of course, but I shall run down and take a look. Perhaps you and your people would like to go into the William now. I shall send her into San Salvador."
"I think I may speak for all the Leopards when I say we should be wretchedly disappointed to be put out of the ship," said Jack with a smile. "We had very much rather stay."
"That's right, sir," said Babington.
And Byron said, "Hear him, hear him!" Lambert had expected no less, but the words gave him pleasure. He acknowledged them with a chuckle and gave orders to wear ship. Round she came, in a long, smooth curve, and steadied on the larboard tack, the same tack as the stranger who was heading out to sea. The William also wore, since their courses would be much the same until the southern cape was weathered, but she was a dull sailor, and the Java, letting fall her topgallants and crossing her royal yards, left her far behind. The Java had plenty of right seamen to sail her, that was clear. The royal yards fairly raced aloft. Jack stepped below for his telescope, and when the rigging was tolerably clear of hands, he went up to the cross-trees to view the distant ship. He paused in the main-top, for although, according to the purser's scales, he had lost 4 stone, he seemed to be heaving a most uncommon weight. Obviously his strength had not yet come back, in spite of these days of good eating. However, from the main-top he could see nothing, because of the foretopsail, so after a while he climbed again. The cross-trees at last, and he found that he was in a muck sweat.
"What a flat I should look! Was I to drop down among them like an act of God?"
he said, glancing at the remote, crowded quarter-deck, so narrow from this height, flecked with the red coats of the marines, the white shirts of hurrying foremast hands, blue-coated officers, the parsons black, all sharp in the brilliant sun. There was not much chance of his dropping, however. These airy regions had been his so long that his hands moved as surely as an ape's. Without thinking of it, he took up the comfortable position he had learnt as a mast-headed midshipman, and unslung his glass. The Java was lying over with a brisk northeastern breeze, making something better than 9 knots, and as he pulled the telescope to its full length, he wondered how long Lambert would keep her under royals. She was somewhat by the head, like all French ships he had ever sailed in, and for his part he would have preferred lower and topmast stunsails, but that was Lambert's business. He knew how to sail his own ship. And fight her, too. Ducking to see under the taut arch of the foretopgallant, he fixed the stranger, focused, and stared long and hard. Yes. She was a frigate, of that there was no doubt. She bore on the Java's starboard bow, sailing into the offing, going from her on the same tack, and he could not count her ports, but a minute examination showed him that she carried these ports high, a strong presumption of her being a heavy, stout-built ship. And although she too was under royals, she did not lean from the strengthening breeze, another mark of a heavy ship. She was probably sailing about as fast as she could go, yet judging from her broad, turbulent wake, that was not very fast. Java would have the legs of her in a long chase. On the other hand, she had not set her lower weather stunsails, nor anything in the way of bonnets or skyscrapers. The Java was not, in fact, in pursuit of a fleeing ship, but of one that meant to draw her away from the land, away from the William, a possible consort, a possible man of war, to draw her far out into the offing, where there was all the sea room in the world. Jack nodded. It was a sensible move. The man over there handled his ship well. But so did Lambert. The Java's fore and main stunsails appeared, aloft and alow, and on his high perch Jack felt the ship respond with a beautiful, eager, living thrust. She was a fine sea-boat, and not only that, but a very much finer ship altogether than the poor old shattered Guerrière, all paint and putty over her shaky timbers, overgunned, undermanned. It appeared to him that they were gaining on the chase, and that in perhaps 3 or 4 hours they would be within gunshot. And then, if she proved to be an American, and he was intimately convinced she was an American, they would put it to the test. He found that his heart was beating so hard that he could scarcely keep the long glass steady. That was no state for going into action, although he was only a mere passenger. Coolness was all. The question was, were they in fact going into action? Was the Java gaining, and if so, by how much? He clapped the glass to, and heaven is forgotten, he shot down on deck like a boy to join Chads on the forecastle. The first lieutenant and Babington were busy with their sextants, measuring the angle subtended by the chase's masthead, leaning right over on the sloping deck. Spray from the fine bow wave swept over them each time the Java pitched, but they had much the same results. The Java was gaining, but only by a little under a mile in 1 hour. At this rate, and if the chase spread more canvas, they could not bring her to action much before nightfall. And then again, was she an American at all?
"We must presume she is," said Chads, "even if it means losing a spar or two."
He looked anxiously up at the whipping stunsail booms.
"Just so," said Jack. "And suppose what we hope proves to be the case, may I suggest you give us a pair of guns? We are used to working together."
"If you would take over the forecastle battery, sir, I shall be infinitely obliged, with numbers 6 and 7 for your own. I had to entrust those two to the marine recruits. 7 kicks a little, but we renewed the breechings last week, and the bolts are sound."
6 and 7, very good. I take it that Captain Lambert will manoeuvre to cross her wake and hang upon her starboard quarter," said Jack. "So we must get our hand in with the larboard gun first."
"Why, no, sir," said Chads. "The captain was speaking of his plan of action not 5 minutes ago. The general asked him how we set about these things at sea, lines of approach, and so on. The captain quoted Lord Nelson's, 'Never mind manoeuvres, go straight at 'em,' declaring that since we had the weather gauge, that was exactly what he meant to do, to go straight at 'em, batter 'em yardarm to yardarm for a while, and then board in the smoke."
Jack was silenced. He could not contradict Lord Nelson, whom he adored, nor could he utter the least criticism of the Java's captain, who had carried a French corvette with a broadside half as heavy again as his own, in just that determined manner. He himself, commanding a ship that moved faster through the water than the chase, would certainly have manoeuvred, playing at long bowls with the enemy, probing him, hitting him on the quarter, endeavouring to rake him, and taking advantage of the leeward attack, with the rising breeze laying the enemy's ports low to the water, perhaps even smothering his fire. On the other hand, in a close engagement, the leeward ship often could not see her opponent through the enormous clouds of smoke. Yet clearly this was no time for expressing his views on the subject, above all since the word was being passed for Mr. Chads. They walked back to the quarterdeck, and a moment later the private signal broke out at the Java's masthead. No reply. The Spanish and Portuguese signals followed. Still no reply. And conviction grew. Conviction grew still stronger. Doubting voices were silenced when the stranger took in her stunsails, hauled her wind, and came about, standing north and west on the starboard tack, apparently to cross the Java's bows. The precision of her turn was impressive, so was the long row of gun ports it revealed. Without any question, she was a 44-gun frigate, tall and stiff. Captain Lambert put his ship about to keep the weather gauge and steered a course parallel to the Americans. They were so close now that he could force an action in the afternoon, even if the big frigate wished to decline it. But for the moment he chose to bide his time, and the ships sailed side by side with a great stretch of sea between them. Jack gathered his leopards, and they looked to their guns, number 6 to starboard and 7 the other side, just under the overhang of the forecastle. Each crew fought a pair of guns except in those ships with a superabundance of hands, and in the unlikely event of their being engaged on both sides at once, the crew ran from one to the other, firing them alternately. The Leopard quickly settled who should be first and second captains, Bondon and Babington, who should be boarders, firemen, sponger, and so on, checked the breaching, drew the charges, having little faith in any loading but their own, recharged, ran the guns in and out 6 times, and drew breath. Those were the familiar 18-pounders, 500-weight a man, and they offered no problems, though the Leopards did not much care for the way Java's jollies had arranged the swabs and rammers, and though in their weakened state they did find the starboard gun heavy to heave inboard against the slope of the deck. But as Bondon observed, once the dust started flying, the recoil would look after that.
Forshaw darted below to report that the chase had worn and shown a waft, thought to be a private signal, and that the Java was about to wear likewise. He was in a state of shrill glee, and his voice went so high that it almost vanished. He looked so frail, so very childish in his oversized, borrowed clothes, that the older man looked at him quite pitifully, and Jack thought, "How I hope that boy don't stop a ball."
"How's your guns?"
he cried aloud, glancing at his watch, which said 1 minute before noon. Immediately afterwards the hands were piped to dinner, and at the same time the drum beat for the officers. This pleased Jack. Lambert meant to take advantage of the last minutes before the galley fires were put out in clearing the ship for action. He and Jack might differ about manoeuvring, but they were of the same mind about going into battle with a full belly. The Java was already almost entirely cleared, and although there was not yet a clean sweep fore and aft, some of the immense amount of baggage belonging to the governor and his suite had still to be struck down into the hold, the cabin bulkheads and furniture were gone, and her captain, General Hislop, Jack, and the captain of the Marines, sitting at a grating slung between two guns, could see their probable, their almost certain adversary as they ate. They were all men who were thoroughly accustomed to fire, and they ate heartily, but rarely did they take their eyes from the American.
"As I was telling Chads," said Lambert to Jack, "my intention is to go the plain, straightforward way about it, to bear down, lay the ship alongside her, hit her as hard as we can, and then board her in the smoke."
"Yes, sir," said Jack.
"We have plenty of willing hands for the job with all our supernumeraries, and I fancy they will make a better fist of it with the cutlass than playing long bowls with the guns. And now I come to think of it, Chads tells me you have very handsomely offered to fight a pair of guns yourself, and to keep an eye on the forward battery. I'm very much obliged to you, Aubrey. I am a lieutenant short, and most of my youngsters are on their first voyage, and 6 and 7 were served by the Marines. Not that they did not serve them pretty well, but Captain Rankin here will be happy to have his small arms men back again."
Rankin agreed, observing that the tops were not nearly as full of sharpshooters as he could wish if the action became really close. One bell struck, and Lambert continued.
"I think it is very nearly time. So, gentlemen, I will give you the king and confusion to his enemies."
The officers walked out onto the quarterdeck. The chase lay about 2 miles ahead to leeward, and both ships were running at a good 10 knots. But now the Java was labouring under her royals, and Captain Lambert had them taken in. Yet even without them she gained perceptibly. And so they ran eastwards, each drawing a long white furrow in the sparkling sea. An empty sea. Nothing to windward, nothing to leeward, and the William had vanished astern long since, while Brazil was no more than a faint cloud-like band from the masthead. And now the stranger, a stranger no longer, nor a chase, displayed a commodore's broad pendant on the main, together with the colours of the United States. Bondon had been right. She was indeed the Constitution. A few moments later her royals too came in, followed by her fore and mainsail, and she hauled to the wind, her speed dropping immediately. It was clear that she meant to fight, and that she had always meant to fight, but to fight as and when it suited her. She had drawn the Java from the land and from the William, and now she was content. An intelligent opponent, reflected Jack, cool and calculating. The Java replied to the American colours with her own, and a Union flag high in the leeward rigging as well, so that there should be no mistake, and she too stripped to her fighting sails. No sound on board but the brief orders, the boatswain's call, the run of seamen's feet, the creaking of blocks, and the song of the wind in the rigging. With the main and foresails hauled up, every man on deck had a clear view of the American as she lay there, her head a little off the north-northeastern wind, and now in total silence Captain Lambert took the Java down as he had promised, slanting across the wind straight for the enemy's larboard quarter. Half an hour would bring them into battle. For those with no immediate tasks at hand, 10 of these 30 minutes passed in a state of suspended activity, the wheel unmoved by so much as a spoke, scarcely a word on the crowded, gravely attentive quarterdeck. Then Captain Lambert nodded to Mr. Chads, and the drum volleyed and thundered fore and aft. Most of the officers and midshipmen ran to their divisions at the guns. The master stepped behind the wheel to con the ship. 3 parties of marines climbed into the tops, trailing their muskets. The surgeons went below, down, down, under the waterline. And silence fell again. Everything was ready.
All along the clean, neat deck, brilliant in the sun, the powder boys stood with their cartridges behind the guns. The shot racks and garlands were full. Thin smoke streamed from the match tubs. The bosun had long since secured the yards with pudding and chains. Deep in the magazine, the gunner waited among his open powder kegs. The fear-naught screens were laid over the hatchways. Jack walked into the comparative darkness of the forecastle, and there at the open port his gun crew was waiting for him. They were stripped to the waist, showing their appalling burns, and most had tied handkerchiefs around their heads against the sweat. They looked at him with a serious, though confident, expression. The neighbouring crews with curiosity and a kind of hopeful deference. Few, apart from the captains, had ever seen a great gun fired in anger, and Captain Aubrey was known to be a master of his trade. Blazing sun beyond the port, and there, exactly framed, the Constitution. A heavy frigate indeed. Now he could gauge the true size of her massive spars, the unusual height of her ports, well clear of the choppy sea breaking white against her side. A tough nut to crack if the Americans could fire their guns as well as they could sail their ship. American seamanship, he knew, but could a fighting ship be improvised? Could 400 officers and men be taught their duty in a few months? A few months, as against the continual practice and tradition of 20 years of war? Unlikely, but not impossible. After all, a great many Americans had learnt gunnery, often much against their will, in the Royal Navy. He had had scores under his command in one ship or another. He hoped Lambert would board as soon as possible. There was something very daunting about the determined attack of hundreds of men swarming over the side with cutlasses and tomahawks. Few ships' companies could withstand it. Behind him, Foreshore, who, being too light to heave upon a tackle with any effect, acted as their powder boy, was explaining to one of the Java's midshipmen that he would feel quite different, quite easy, once the dust began to fly. "I generally chew a quid of tobacco while we're going into action," he added, "and I encourage my men to do the same. It makes the awkward waiting pass much quicker." In the cockpit, where, by the light of 3 hanging lanterns, the surgeons were putting a final razor edge on their instruments by means of an oiled silkstone, Stephen said to Mr. Fox, "Do you not find, sir, that your perception of time is strangely altered on these occasions, when—" "That rat, Mr. McClure. You may certainly strike that rat if you are brisk." Mr. Fox was obliged to admit that he had not experienced such an occasion before, but he hoped that presently the dispersion of stimuli would have a lenitive effect, that the din of battle and the necessary activity would dispel a certain illogical uneasiness, or rather impatience. "There!" cried Stephen, flinging a retractor at a particularly bold rat. "I very nearly had him, the thief. Surely, Mr. Fox, you have more than your fair share of rats aboard. Have you thought of introducing a parcel of weasels? We find them answer admirably in Ireland." "I thought you had no weasels, no serpents, no salamanders in your country." "No more we have. The Irish weasels are all stoats, but they are the devil for rats." A tremendous triple knock, a bang or crash reverberating along the cable tiers, cut off the surgeon's reply. The Constitution had opened fire at half a mile, and 3 of her round shot had struck the Java's side on the ricochet.
"Good practice," observed Jack.
And as he watched, bent low to see through the port, he saw another jet of smoke from one of the Americans' afterguns. The shot struck the sea, skipped 3 times, with each splash in a direct line for his eye, came aboard, a muffled thump in the tight-packed forecastle hammocks, and could be heard rolling about overhead. Foreshore darted out and came back with a ball, a 24-pounder.
"A pity it is so big," said Jack, turning it over. "I remember when I was a boy in Ajax, and the Apollon was blazing away at us like Guy Fawkes Night. A spent 18-pound ball came in at our port. The lieutenant, it was Mr. Horner. You remember him, Bondon?"
"Oh, yes, sir. A very sprightly gentleman that loved his laugh.
He picked it up, called for a piece of chalk, wrote 'Post paid' on the ball, rammed it down our gun, and so sent it back in double quick time."
"Ha, ha, ha," went the gun crew, and their neighbours on either side.
"And not long after that, he was made a post captain. Ha, ha, ha."
Nearer, and the Java was almost on the Constitution's larboard beam. The American side vanished in a cloud of smoke. Her broadside, some 700 pounds of iron, ripped up the water, a series of white fountains short of their mark by 100 yards, and a few harmless balls struck the Java's side. Nearer still. Little more than musket range, and they could see their enemies' faces. They stood poised and tense over their guns, waiting for the order to fire, Bonden glaring along the barrel, perpetually shifting it with his handspike as the Constitution came full in the beam. Point-blank range. But still no order. The Americans were running out their guns. Jack had been counting the seconds from the first broadside, and he reached 120 before the vast thundering eruption hid the enemy again, all but her t'gun masts, that could be seen high above the smoke, quivering from the shock. This time the whole well-grouped broadside raced humming deep far overhead. 2 minutes. Quite good gun drill, though he had managed 70 seconds, and they had misjudged the "Fire as they bear!" The welcome order came as the Java reached the top of her roll and was just beginning to lean to leeward. The whole of her starboard broadside roared out, and instantly the deck was filled with smoke, with a marvellous powder smell. Laughing aloud, Jack and his mates clapped on, ran the gun in, sponged, reloaded, rammed home the charge, working like powerful machines, and as the smoke cleared they saw that they had hit her hard. Gaps in the hammocks, the wheel destroyed, some shrouds and a backstay hanging loose. On either side the Javas cheered like fury, and as they heaved so they came closer still, within pistol shot of the Constitution's bow. And at pistol shot the Constitution fired again. A few splintering crashes aft, but nothing to interrupt the cheers forward as they ran their guns out, thumping them hard against the sills. Yet as they peered into the dense cloud of American smoke to point their loaded guns, staring and ludicrously fanning with their hands, the sail trimmers were called. The Constitution, having fired, had instantly filled her headsails and put before the wind. She had worn, and the Java, without waiting to catch her and rake her on the turn, was wearing after her. The starboard guns no longer bore. The Leopards exchanged a glance. The smoke cleared entirely, drifting away in a solid bank, and showed the Constitution well to leeward, with the Java coming up fast on her quarter, but still turning with her as she hauled up on the other tack, presenting her undamaged starboard ports. In the long pause, Jack hurried up and down the forecastle battery, making them stop their noise, house the starboard guns safely, and cast loose those on the other side. The two Java midshipmen, first voyagers, had no notion of anything beyond the formal movements of the great gun exercise. His heart was still beating high with the immense vitality of battle, and this violent activity, heaving, shoving men into their places, checking the tackle falls, breaching, cartridges, grape and round shot, covered the uneasy feeling in the back of his mind. Lambert might have missed one golden chance, but there would soon be another. Very soon. The Java was ranging up on the Constitution's starboard side. The larboard guns, trained hard forward, began to bear, and as they bore, so they fired. 1, 3, and 5 together, and as Bonden fired number 7, he saw the shot strike the Constitution's main chains just before the smoke swept down. But now there were orange flashes in the smoke as the American after-guns replied, and after a few savage moments both full broadsides were at work, a continuous bellowing roar, punctuated by the even louder crashes of the next-hand guns and the carronades overhead. A prodigious, omnipresent din, and in it the kicking number 7 broke its breaching after the 4th discharge. Worse than that, number 3 had been dismounted, and there were several men lying on the deck, including both midshipmen. Leaving the practiced Leopards to their tasks, Jack ran to trip and secure the gun. Its crew had little notion of what to do, but by gesture and bellow and example in the incessant roar and clangour, he got them to make it fast, slid a dead man through the port, and made them carry the wounded below. The fire was very hot, with a furious discharge of musketry as well, almost as hot as he had known it, and there were 3 of the main deck guns knocked out, perhaps some of the larboard carronades too. Amidships and aft the pattern of the Java's fire was gone. An officer running to deal with the confusion was shot dead from the Constitution's tops, and the next moment his body was struck, jerked against the starboard rail by a 24-pound ball. But that was the last shot from the Constitution's great guns, the last for this bout. An eddy cleared the smoke, and they saw her wearing once again, wearing very fast. This time Lambert quickly let fly his topsail sheets, checking the Java's way. Jack smiled. Clearly Lambert meant to cross the Constitution's wake, raking her from stern to stem, the most damaging fire a ship could receive.
"Sir, sir!"
cried the midshipman from number 11, the gun to which poor Broughton had been running.
"What shall we do? The shot is jammed!"
Jack had taken 3 strides aft when he fell. It was nothing, he found, scrambling up and slipping again in Broughton's blood.
a musket ball had grazed his head. But now the Java was beginning her turn. In less than a minute, she would cross the Constitution's wake right under her stern, a beautifully calculated move. Yet most of these poor, brave, willing, silly fools were milling about to port, unaware that the starboard guns would be engaged.
"T'other side! T'other side!"
he roared on his feet at last. They raced across the deck, willing and eager in spite of the hail of small arms fire, but to his utter horror he realized that on quitting them they had not reloaded their starboard guns. The turn continued. The Constitution's tall, unprotected, naked, infinitely vulnerable stern was right before the Java's broadside. The Java, so beautifully steered that her main yardarm crossed the Constitution's very taffrail, and only a single gun went off. Cursing did no good. Blasphemy brought bad luck. Jack split his remaining crew. Mr. Byron had copped it with a nasty splinter in his chest. Bates the Flitch had lost the number of his mess, divided them among the other forward guns and helped load two or three. There was no time for cursing either. The Java was running alongside the Constitution, and now the fire resumed its utmost fury, firing, reloading, firing again as fast as the powder could run up from the magazine. And all the time he had to try to stop the Javas from madly overcharging, from ramming two cartridges into their guns and any bits of metal they could find. The Americans' aim was better now, and they were firing low. The 24-pound balls sent splinters racing across the deck in clouds, great jagged lumps of sharp-edged wood, and one of these struck Bondon down. Jack heaved him out of the way of the recoiling gun, and when it had fired, knelt by him on the deck and shouted into his deafened ear,
"Only a hand's breadth of scalp. Your pigtail's all right. Get you below for a stitch."
"Bowsprit's gone, sir," said Bondon, peering through his blood, and following his gaze Jack saw the jib and forestaysail blowing free.
"Give the doctor my regards," said he, and ran along the deck, checking each gun, helping to point, cheering the men.
Not that they needed much cheering. They were firing much better, much faster, now they had the hang of it, and they roared like devils as their shot went home. No sign of flinching from the guns, though three ports were battered into one, and amidships the dead and wounded lay by the score, blood oozing thick.
"Heave! Heave!"
bawled Jack at number three, and as the gun ran up he stared into the smoke to place his shot, waiting for the roll with his mates poised over the scorching barrel. But this time there was no shifting hint of the enemy's side. The roll came, again, and still the thick smoke lay. Nothing beyond it as it cleared. The American had worn again.
"Hands about ship!"
came the cry, and then,
"Ready, oh!"
The sail trimmers ran to their stations, and in the silence Jack moved back to the forward scuttlebutt and took a long, long-needed drink. Lambert was going to tack, rather than wear, so as to cut the Constitution on her turn, to cut across her stern. A fine move, if only the Java could make it quick enough. There was little way on her, and her headsails were gone. Here was Bondon, a reddening bandage all round his head.
"All right, sir?"
he asked. Jack nodded and said,
"Warm work, Bondon. How are things below? How is Mr. Byron?"
"Mr. Byron looks a bit old-fashioned, sir, as far as I could see. Powerful lot of work down there. Doctor's as busy as a bee. Sends his love, though. Their premier, Mr. Chads, he got a nasty swipe."
The Leopards had no stations for tacking ship. They gathered round their captain and drank deep from the scuttlebutt as the Java swung up into the wind. Slowly. Slowly.
"I have no notion of all this wearing," said Babington.
"He may do it once too often," said Jack. "The most dangerous movement I have—"
"Christ, we're going to miss stays," whispered Babington.
And indeed, with neither jib nor forestaysail, it looked as though the Java could not cross the wind's eye, but must fall off, stern to the enemy, now a quarter of a mile to leeward. Jack glanced aft, and there she was, luffing up to show her starboard broadside. In another minute the Java would be raked.
"Lie down," he said,
pressing on Forshaw's shoulder, and the broadside came, striking the Java's stern and tearing the whole length of her deck. But in the same moment her backed for topsail filled, and slowly she began to pay off. She was round.
"Larboard guns!"
cried Jack, springing up, and now the Javas scarcely needed any teaching. They flew to their guns, and as the ship turned a little further, they returned the fire, a hearty though ragged volley that went right home. And once again the Constitution wore. The Java came straight down for her, ranged alongside, received her fire, returned it, the guns so hot that they leapt clear of the deck at each discharge. Rough work. Rough work.
The difference between 24 and 18 pounds was telling now, and the Java could not stand much more of it. In the short seconds between guns, between making the cheering men reduce their charge, fire low and steady, and swab clean, Jack saw the enormous wreckage amidships, the shattered boats, the grim wounds in the mainmast, and above all in the unstayed foremast.
"We must board," he said to himself. "We still have about 300 men.
And as the words formed, he heard Lambert roar, "Borders away!" The Java bore up, heading straight at the Constitution's side. The boarders swarmed onto the forecastle, cutlasses, pistols, axes ready. Chads was there again, pale at his captain's side. Both of them caught Jack's eye, a savage, eager grin. A few yards more and there would be the crash of impact, the spring aboard, the hot work, hand to hand. The Americans were firing from their tops as fast as they could load. It made no odds to the furious impatience of the crowd of men poised for their leap. But then, over all the din, cutting clear through, the high, shrieking hail from the Java's foretop.
"Stand from under!"
And the mast, the towering great edifice of the foremast, with all its spreading yards, its fighting top, its sails, its countless ropes and blocks, came crashing down, the lower part kicking aft to cover the main deck, the upper covering the forecastle. There was an immense amount of rigging, of spars over them, and over the forward guns. There were some men pinned, others wounded, and for the next few minutes, in the fury of clearing so that the guns could fire, Jack lost all track of the relative position of the ships. When at last the forward battery was to some extent restored, he saw the Constitution well ahead, in the act of wearing across the Java's bows. Not a gun could the Java fire in this position, and the Constitution raked her deliberately from stem to stern, killing a score of men and bringing down her main topmast. Once again the wild labour of clearing, slashing at the wreckage with axes, anything that came to hand, and now the Constitution lay on their starboard quarter, pouring in a diagonal fire, lay there a moment before bearing up and giving the Java her full larboard broadside.
"Captain's down," said a Java, having carried a wounded mate below. "But Mr. Chads is back."
"Never say die,"
cried the captain of his gun, and firing he knocked away the Constitution's main topsail yard to a frenzy of cheering all along the deck. Yet at the same time the Java's gaff and spanker boom went by the board, and a little after the mizzenmast followed them. The Javas, undismayed, fired like demons, streaming with sweat under the smoky sun, often with blood, and the stabbing flames from almost every shot they fired set light to the tarred wreckage hanging over the side. Fire buckets, powder, fire buckets, powder. The remaining officers had them running in a continual stream. At one point the ships were side by side again, and the Java's great guns gave as good as they got, or at least did all they could to do so. And she being low in the water now, some of her round shot made cruel wounds. But the Java lacked her fighting tops. Fore and mizzen were gone, and the main top was a wreck, whereas the American did not. Her tops were filled with marksmen, and it was one of these that brought Jack down. The blow knocked him flat, but he thought nothing of it until on getting up he found that his right arm would not obey him, that it was hanging at an unnatural angle. He stood, swaying, for with two masts and all but one sail gone, the Java was rolling very heavily. And as he stood amidst the din, still shouting at the crew of number 9 to depress their gun, an oak splinter knocked him down again. He had a vague awareness of Killick's voice swearing at a marine.
"Handsomely, handsomely, you fat-ass Dutch-built bugger!"
And then he came fully to his wits as Stephen leant over him, searching the wound.
"Stephen," he said, "quick, just bind it up, splint it up. You shall have it off afterwards if you wish. I must go on deck."
Stephen nodded, splinted and bound the arm, and turned to a man lying on his own liver while Jack made his way through the long, long rows among the smell of blood to the ladder. On the quarterdeck he found Chads, equally bandaged, equally pale, with a fine determined light blazing in his eye. Chads was now in command of the ship. He was getting the wreckage of the mizzen free before the heavy floating mast should ram the Java with its butt end, sending her to the bottom a little before her time. The carpenter and the gunner and the armourer were all standing by him, awaiting for the chance to have a word.
"Pray go forward, sir, if you can," he said to Jack. "If we can get her before the wind, we'll board her yet."
Forward he went along the bloody deck, lurching on the enormous roll and watching the Constitution.
She had run ahead out of gunshot, and her people were busy knotting and splicing. The thin gun crews he passed were in high spirits, bawling after the American, challenging her to come back and have it out. Game, young cox, he reflected, hurrying faster. With such men, if only they could get before the wind, and if only they could fall aboard the American, they might carry her yet. He had known victory snatched from a situation worse than this, with an overconfident enemy making a mistake. Constitution had already made at least two very dangerous moves. She might make another. On the forecastle, Babington and a party of seamen had roused an almost undamaged t'gallant mast from the wreckage of the booms, and they were trying to make a jury foremast of it. But the Java's roll, and even more, her pitch, was so violent that they were having a cruel time with it, and at every pitch wreckage from the maintop showered down on them, while the remnant of the mainmast itself, with never a shroud on either side and backstays gone, threatened to fall outboard at any moment.
"The mainmast must go," said Jack. "Foreshore, jump to the quarterdeck and ask Mr. Chads for permission and for the carpenter's crew. Foreshore! Where is Foreshore?"
Nobody answered for a moment, and then Babington said, "Gone, sir. Blasted over the side."
"Oh, Christ!"
said Jack. A very slight pause, and then,
"Hollis, cut along!"
Hollis came back with the carpenters and their axes. The mast was gone, clean over the side, and the ship was steadier. Chads and all the seamen from aft were now on the forecastle, working on the jury foremast with intense effort and concentration, and all the time the gun crews cheered and called after the Constitution. The jury mast rose up, straight up. They made all fast, rigged out a lower stunsail boom. The awkward sail rose, filled, and the Java gathered way, answering her helm. She turned, bringing the wind a little abaft the beam, and moved towards the distant Constitution, her tattered ensign flying from the mizzen's stump. With only one arm, and that his left, there was little that Jack could do at this point. He stood by Chad's as they turned aft, considering the situation. The deck before them was a shambles. They could see a dozen guns dismounted, and there were others they could not see. The boats were all shattered, and then, of course, there was the blood. But it was not a hopeless shambles. The one pump that had not been destroyed was pumping hard. The crews stood by their guns, ready and eager. All the boarders had their weapons there at hand. A marine stepped forward to strike one bell in the first dog watch, a cracked and tinny sound. Jack fumbled awkwardly for his watch with his left hand, automatically checking the time. A vain attempt. All he brought out was a twisted gold case and a handful of glass and little wheels. The carpenter stepped up to Chad's and said,
6'4" in the well, sir, if you please, and gaining fast.
Then we had better go aboard the American at once, said Chads with a smile. They looked forward, and there was the American. She had completed her repairs, and as they watched, she filled, wore, and came towards them on the starboard tack. Now was the time to profit from a God-sent mistake. Now or never. If the Constitution would only neglect the weather gauge, would only come close enough to allow them to board in a last dash through her fire. But the Constitution intended nothing of the kind. Deliberately and under perfect control, she crossed the Java's bows at rather more than 200 yards, shivered her main and mizzen topsails, and lay there, gently rocking, her whole almost undamaged larboard broadside looking straight at the dismasted Java, ready to rake her again and again. With her single sail right forward, the Java could not move into the wind, could no longer approach the Constitution. All she could do was to make a slow starboard turn to bring her 7 port guns to bear. By the time they could fire, she would have been raked 3 times at point-blank range. In any case, the Constitution would not wait until they bore, but fill again and circle her. The Constitution lay there. With evident forbearance, she did not open fire. Jack could see her captain looking earnestly at them from his quarterdeck.
No, said Chads in a dead voice. It will not do.
He looked at Jack, who bowed his head, then walked aft, as a resolute man might walk to the gallows, walked between the sparse gun crews, silent now, and hauled the colours down.